been a minute since you've heard from us, and we've missed you all. But we didn't want 2020 to end without one final episode of Our Voices, Our Community. On today's episode, we're going to talk about the year that was and the year that is to come. The good, bad, and yes, the ugly. As always, we'll touch on local, statewide, and national issues because 2020 has been a year. So let's get started. The voice that you're hearing today is Karen Jones. Robert Jeffrey is not with us, but you guys will hear from him again soon. And today I'm joined by Will Solari. Will, how are you?
I'm alive. I've been COVID-free so far and somehow got employed again. So, you know, fingers crossed. I've been furloughed, but... we're getting the end of the tunnel is like getting close. So
good. What more can we ask for than a little bit of light at the end of that tunnel? So
yeah,
excited. Also with us is Reverend Kevin McNeil. Reverend McNeil, how are you?
I am doing well. As I said earlier, you know, I'm just blessed to be here. Blessed to have another day. I'll take it one day at a time. 2020 has really taught me to appreciate the blessings of each day. So, you know, in the midst of everything that's going on, my focus every day is to find something positive. So I'm blessed.
That is awesome. Awesome. And last but definitely not least, Miss Catherine Cable. How are you today?
I am good. 2020 is coming to a close, and someone I live with is getting vaccinated on Friday.
Oh. Wow.
That's right. So we're very excited about that. We have not been excited about the most of the rest of 2020, but we're ending strong.
No, that is great. And then, but let's talk about that a little bit, because the year that was 2020 has been this crazy thing that we call COVID-19, the coronavirus. I don't know, maybe it's a curse. I don't know. But let's talk about that, because that has been the genesis for any and everything that has happened. So so the vaccine, great, it's coming out. But how do you all think that the coronavirus and the ways in which we've dealt with it has affected 2020 or even changed our lives?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's easy to blame everything on the coronavirus, but, you know, the coronavirus is almost a natural disaster, right? I remember how George Bush handled Katrina. I mean, it's not super different. You know, we were faced with a lot of adversity as a country and as the world, and you saw the leaders that were able to help do their best in those situations and handle it with grace. And we saw a lot of missteps and a lot of just kind of blatant narcissism in the face of science and reason and really the overall good and public health of the country. So, you know, the coronavirus, yeah, I mean, that's top of the, like, you know, it's sitting at the head of the supervillain table, but that's a whole like injustice league around, right, you know, the coronavirus, as it were. So I think give credit where credit's due, but also, you know, had a lot of help along the way.
Yeah. And
least of which, you know, our wonderful, my favorite senator, Mitch McConnell. So, you know. If we wanted to spend the whole hour talking about Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, the GOP's mishandling of science just in general, I mean, we could do that if you want, but I think everybody sort of knows the score.
Yeah, I think we know the horrendousness that has come from the top, you know, from our leaders. And so I don't think we need to rehash any of that, because 2021 is going to bring something new. But I am curious, Reverend McNeil, because one of the things this year is that our faith communities have really had to examine themselves, I would say, in how we are reaching. And that's whether we are Christians of the Jewish, like what Jewish faith, whatever it is, we've really had to reimagine. Like, what are your thoughts kind of from that perspective?
Well, I think when we start looking at 2020 and the effect that it had on faith communities, it really exposed the faith communities and the deficits, all of the challenges that we have, the things we politely don't talk about, you know, the rigidity of the modern church, and also just some of the wild outlandish thinking too. The church, I think, now finds itself in a place, and I mean Church Universal, in a place where it has got to reexamine itself and kind of take that look in the mirror, because what we saw in 2020, I think, has been the church struggle with dealing with issues of public policy, the church struggle dealing with issues of faith, issues of finance, and how we've handled those challenges, and technology. You know, we've laughed about the fact that the churches that are still somewhat thriving or surviving, not just are the churches that were able to take that 20-year jump into the technology age, and still find themselves relevant. Even here in Southwest Virginia, there are churches that, and I've talked to pastors who aren't sure if their congregations are going to come back. Mm. Because there are literally churches where there's been no real contact since March.
This is when that conversation about the good internet is extremely relevant.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. All right.
Well, you know, I'm blessed in this weird sense because, you know, my bachelor's degree is in computer science. So I'm a techie, which usually when people find out, they go, well, how does that work with faith? You know, you're a science guy. How does that work with faith? And I go, oh, God's a scientist. It all works out.
Absolutely. I really think
God just invented the internet.
Right. God's a tinkerer, you know. But many of those mainline, staunch, old, what I would call old world theologians struggled with this idea of not being in a building, not singing those old hymns, not doing those things that we used to do. Our church went to the parking lot worship the second week that everybody was at. The first week the weather was bad, so we were at home. The next week we were in the parking lot, and a couple of other churches, Blacksburg Christian Church and a couple of others, followed suit. And there was literally a theologian at Lexington Theological Seminary who wrote an op-ed saying that what we were doing was untheological.
What?
And it went out to the whole denomination. And so there was this, so there was a struggle. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, so we're doing communion via Zoom or communion via Facebook Live or now YouTube Live. It's whatever. You know, he says, as often as you do this, he didn't say as often as you do this at 3115 Fleming Avenue. He just says as often as you do
as
it.
As you do it, right.
And so,
the church has been exposed, I think, in 2020.
Reverend, do you think that some of the, you know, if you go to a Lutheran church, you know, it's a very distinct look and feel, like you said, you know, they're singing. Part of the whole deal with the choir is the way it sounds and their kind of place of worship, and the look and whole feel is there. I mean, do you think some of the reluctance for people to kind of take that next step towards social media, the internet, is just because it's new? Or do you think, you know, like televangelists kind of embraced it, so did it get like a bad look? Or what do you think is the precipice for people being sort of reluctant about kind of, you know, extending their reach, as it were?
Peer pressure.
Yeah.
somebody had a friend of mine that said this. They said the tradition is just peer pressure from old people.
Mm. Yeah. And I'm stealing that because that is good.
Brilliant.
Good.
And
people are all about the peer pressure. I'm sorry. Like, that does not end in high school. Whoever said that, whoever said that is over in high school lied to everybody.
Yeah.
Yes. So, you know, so part of the challenge, I think, has been we get accustomed to what we get accustomed to, and we think our tradition is the tradition, mm-hmm. and it's not right if it's not done a certain way. And I said in a meeting between ministers when we were talking about the article that was written, and I said, well, because he kept railing against technology, and I said, well, technically, a hymn book is technology.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first thing made with a printing press was was the Bible.
Yeah.
And let me tell you, the Catholic Church was not happy about that. The Catholic Church was not happy about that technology. They were not into it. They were against it.
They had a very specific and artisan industry producing Bibles, which, you know, say what you will about the printing press. I think there was something lost when you didn't have people just like, I mean, those works of art, beautiful. Uh-huh. So I kind of get it.
Yeah, but also what 2020 has exposed is our love affair with what we do. Mm. I stopped using the word church when referring to the church. When I am like in service on Sundays, I talk about a community of faith. Because I realized, and I said this to someone, I said, you know, the only real tradition that Christians, any Christian, or should have, in this, I think, extends to other faith communities as well. There are simply two things. It's your fundamental dogmatic belief. If you're a Christian, you believe in Jesus Christ, death, burial, resurrection, ascension, and a second coming. Outside of that, the only other tradition that we can hang our hat on is change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because if you look at using Christianity as an example, if you look at Old Testament and New Testament texts, you recognize in Old Testament texts, nothing ever stayed the same. In New Testament texts, it was a constant evolution. Mm-hmm. And we are just in this sliver of time, and we say, well, this is what feels good to us. And we don't want to do anything else. And so it kind of boxes in this whole understanding of what it means to be holy.
I think it is good to hallmark, though, of 2020 in the sense that, you know, you gave faith communities jobs, places that for the longest time said could never be virtual, would never work unless you, you know, fly halfway across the country and sit down for a meeting for an hour and a half just to fly back. These kind of ridiculous traditions, you know, whether, again, but they were of different religions or they were just business practices or whatever,
right.
Could never work any other way. You know, I went to two weddings via Zoom, and I thought that was kind of incredible because I love those friends of mine. I wasn't going to go to Texas for their wedding, even if there was no pandemic. Just not a thing that could have happened anyways. But again, I was able to participate in a way that people didn't really think about before. And I, you know, I found that aspect of it, again, you know, if your business forever said, you know, you can't work from home, that'll never work. You have to show up, you know, you have to spend an hour driving back and forth every day and it's going to be a mess. Here's my friend works for Indeed, you know, then they give him like $500. They're like, build a home office. Here's some money for your internet. If this works better for you, keep doing it.
Right.
And I think that's people embracing that challenge, I think, was one of the upsides to it. Because again, who knew about Zoom before this year? You know, or what you could do with Microsoft Teams or any of that kind of stuff. And I think the way that paradigm shift and the people who are able to embrace it, you can see how they thrived.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, though, that has been a bright spot for me kind of in my worship is that I've been able to worship with others and with other denominations and kind of change, being able to look at, because I'm very traditional. I think I've mentioned this to y'all before. I'm United Methodist. I am like, this is what the order of worship looks like. Here's how we do it. You don't like it. And I need to be home in time by 12:15, 12:30. Like, that's kind of where I'm at. What I found in this time is that Reverend McNeil, I've joined you in worship. I've joined other faith communities in worship locally and kind of across the state that I never would have done before because I am for lack of a better word, loyal to my church home, right? And so it has opened up and really made me look at, okay, we got to start thinking differently. We got to start doing differently, because at the end of the day, we have to reach people where they are. But I've also been amazed at how some of the smaller faith communities have stepped up in super big ways to address the needs, but how larger faith communities who have resources and all of these things have not. And I'm not here to judge, but I'm...
Although, let me just put this out there. If you're Joel Osteen and you get $4 million PPP loan from the government, and you're making millions and millions and millions of dollars in donations and on book sales anyways, is that really who needs that money the most? I mean, is that, I think you can find where those bigger churches, those mega churches and places like that took a hit because they need those people coming in all the time. But also it sort of points out, how little they are actually doing if they need all or are taking advantage of all these things because they supposedly need them.
Right.
All right. So a slightly minor connection to this. I just have to talk about Liberty University. Liberty.
We got to talk about Falwell.
Right. Falwell was a major 2020 story, but also if you think about it, Liberty was one of the first big tech, online degrees, distance learning.
Yeah.
They were huge into that, and they made a ton of money that way. And I think, looking at that and examining, where that went right and also where that went wrong, Liberty has been criticized, heavily for their graduates not having that being sold on a certain degree, but then not having it being very expensive first off, and maybe not worth maybe having that 4-year degree not really be worth more than what somebody would have gotten from their local community college or something more local to them. If that does that make, I don't know, in terms of what they were selling. They were selling the prestige of a 4-year degree, but they actually could not give that in many ways because people discount those Liberty degrees. Those are discounted.
But if you think about all the rules that someone who's, 18 to 24 has to go by and attending Liberty University, it's just not realistic for a lot of people, right? And so they excelled on the tech end of that because it's like, oh, I can do Liberty, but not have a girlfriend and hold hands around campus. Like I can, not have to, do these ridiculous things. But that kind of irony, I guess, or not, what am I trying to say? That sort of dissonance about that is the same thing with Falwell. Where all that stuff went on with him, and he said, well, you know what? I'm not a faith leader, so I shouldn't be held, to these kind of standards or whatever. And they're like, you might want to check where you're the director and president of before you, say that I'm not accountable to the same standards that our students are. And again, I think that's at its core, that's the deal with Liberty. I'm curious to see what the next chapter for them is post-Falwell. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of those traditions, were very much linked to his father and the way that he, ran their church, which, is not something that I was ever in agreement with. And he sort of carried some of that over as a namesake and whatever else. But again, I think Liberty 2.0 is going to be a curious thing, because it's not going to be sustainable unless they, really figure out what makes them shine and stop turning people away.
Right.
I can tell you as a Liberty graduate.
Oh, yes. We get the firsthand account.
Because both of my master's degrees come from Liberty. So, Catherine, I experienced the disdain a little bit that comes from having a degree from Liberty kind of firsthand. Because, and I was literally just having this conversation with somebody on yesterday, because when you start thinking about seminaries, I went to Liberty because I was going back to seminary, going to seminary as a third career person. And while even though I was already ordained, it was, you need to go to seminary here because this is what our denomination says, that in order to be a, you know, a real preacher, you have to go and get this degree. So I said, all right, fine. I'll, you know, I'm coming from another denomination. I'll just do whatever I have to do to comply. And I looked around and it became this thing of what's easy, because I work a full-time job and now I've got to go take classes full-time and I am working a secular job. So it's not like I'm working. I was in the full-time of the church at the time. So it wasn't like I could just say, okay, well, I'm going to go to school Monday through Friday and I'll be back to preach on Sunday. And so Liberty was that place that said, hey, you can do it online. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to go there. It's an accredited university. However, in theological terms, there's an accreditation called ATS, which is American Theological Seminaries, which is the highest form of theological accreditation a school can attain. Liberty, back in the 80s or 90s, tried to get ATS accreditation, and because of the political relationships with Falwell at the time, they were denied. And so he said at that point he would never again attempt to have to apply for ATS accreditation. He would just make his school so big that it wouldn't matter. Me, of course, I don't know any of this background. I'm just going, this place, it's close. So on the classes that I have to do as intensives, it's an hour drive, and I can drive back home the same day, get through school, and then it's like you go out into the world, and people want to talk about, well, where'd you go to school? And, you know, I'm a Florida kid, so the first thing I was talking about is Miami. And they go, no, where'd you go to seminary at? Oh, Liberty. And it's the, you know, that look of disdain, like, you went to Liberty? And it's like, yeah. And so there is that kind of prejudiced kind of a thing.
Right. So they took your money. They didn't warn you that people were going to give you that look.
Yeah.
And
did that be in the packet?
I almost feel like the online like needs to like divorce itself from the like, I mean, maybe that's what's happening, is that they're getting a bit of a divorce from the Falwell politics, you know?
Well, and I think they probably do need to do that, because I think this last election cycle really highlighted just all the ugliness of it.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, anyone who cites Donald Trump as a faith leader, there's such a strong cognitive, you know, dissonance, and being able to make that leap, I don't understand. Especially if you're a university or a place that touts some of the values that Liberty does. It's the same with having Falwell there. You know, you can't hold those two truths. Right. And you know, and this is just superficial. But I think it's indicative of how, if you have such a binary worldview, and such kind of black and white thinking in terms of your university. You know, there's a lot of people in this area who got film and television degrees from Liberty. And some of them, you know, are just like everybody else. But a lot of them are really technically proficient, super, you know, beautiful image makers. They can edit their asses off. They're really good, but they just have nothing to say. And I feel like that's sort of the core of part of what their kind of what their education system has become, because of how just mixed up their education and faith-based things are, that, you know, again, you learn these very, like, almost like you're, you know, just memorizing and the technical aspects of something, but never really quite what it means. Like, don't critically think about this too much, because that might be, you know, that's outside of our, you know, right, our comfort zone, in which we're going to look bad. Because again, you know, Donald Trump is not a faith leader. Jerry Falwell Jr. is not a faith leader, but yet we hold these people up on these pedestals. So
the question I was asked about my son's my older son was here at the very beginning, hanging out. He's 14. We're the size 14 shoe. Is about 6 foot tall and about 340, 350 pounds. Great basketball player, great football player, great student. Was just asked if he was going to wrestle this year. And somebody asked me, they said, well, you know, how would you feel about your son going to your alma mater? And there again, immediately I went back to my, I said, well, if he wants to go to Miami, he's going to be around. I have a lot of family, you know, in Miami. Cool. He'll, you know, that'll be cool. He'll be close to my parents. So he's going to eat really good.
Yeah.
They said, no, Liberty. And I said, oh, he wouldn't last. I said, neither one of my sons would ever do well on campus at Liberty in the current construct. And they said, why? And I said, because they think too much. They're going to ask too many questions. And I said, that's the challenge, I think, when you have kids that are not the traditional Southern Baptist, that kind of a mindset. You really have to start asking yourself the question, you know, is my child going to do well here? He at 14 and 12, they were up in arms throughout this whole election cycle about a myriad of things. I'm like, yeah, they get kicked off campus.
And yeah. Get that so phone call. Can you come pick them up, please?
Well, again, and maybe that's one thing we missed too. Swalwell's whole mask of the governor and all that stuff, like, it's just not okay. You know, I mean, I don't understand how, you know, especially if you have a thriving enterprise like Liberty, how you can just consecutively let all of your BS get in the way of your mission, core values, all that kind of stuff, even despite the fact that they're a religious university, just in general. And again,
it doesn't.
Yeah.
So in every class, I also, my other master's degree is in counseling.
Mm-hmm.
So in every single class I had at Liberty, even electives, there had to be a Christian component.
Right.
There had to be something that tied back to a religious train of thought that was deeply embedded in what they already think. Not what do you think about this, but this is what they already think. And so it was easy for me to go through seminary online because I was already a grown adult who had already been through catechisms and all of these things. So I did not have a whole lot of issues, but the few times I had to go on campus for intensives, I'm watching 18, 19, 20-year-old kids have meltdowns in some of these classes because they don't think like the instructor thinks.
Sure.
And so they have this whole indoctrinal system. And so when you see him say something, or previously we saw him say something or have doubt, that's the feel of that campus. And
weird.
And the challenge with that is that's also the feel of a lot of congregations in and around our country. Because where else do you get that power?
Sure.
Which means there are a lot of people sitting in these lofty places that have these thought processes, and what they have really done is flipped. And instead of their faith, religious belief affecting how they vote, it's how I vote affects my religious belief.
Yeah, so if we zoomed out a little bit and we were to look at that triad, you know, you have the GOP, you have a faith-based community, and, you know, you frankly, on the third, you know, prong of that, you have basically Trump supporters now. There's Venn diagrams with all of them, but they're the people marching on the Capitol the other day about the fraudulent election and everything, you know, attacked churches, tore signs down from churches. And again, they were black churches, which is not super shocking, but I just don't understand how all of this works together anymore. You know, I feel like it was a fragile relationship at first, going back in the 80s when when, you know, some sort of extreme, you know, Christian groups were courting Republicans and all that kind of stuff. But man, I mean, where do you go in 2021 for them if the message is sort of hate? You know, I mean, if the Trump supporters are saying destroy the GOP and the GOP is still backing Trump in some of those weird ways with like the thing in Texas. And then, you know, faith-based communities, again, it's like, you know, if you were actually following the sort of teachings of any, just any religion, you'd be real upset with Mitch McConnell right now. So I don't get, you know, what the next steps are for all of those groups. And again, I have a feeling we're going to see exactly like what happened at Liberty. They're just going to start self-destructing, or they're going to have to entirely reinvent themselves.
So that's kind of a good kind of move, because as we talk about the faith communities, particularly our churches and what that looks like, but 2020, we also saw some racial strife, for lack of a better word, I guess. We also saw, we had 8 minutes and 46 horrific seconds that like changed our lives. I think it exposed something that we, particularly the Black community, knew, but opened the eyes because of COVID and the coronavirus. We're sitting at home glued to our TVs. And so we had all of this happen. So in terms of kind of this divide that has increased racially, what, like, I'm not sure what my question is right now, but 2020, what has that taught us in terms of our racial harmony? Do we have harmony? Will we have harmony? How do we get to harmony? Do we need harmony? I don't know. Thought.
I mean, you're never going to have harmony with that 10% of those, like the angry white dudes who believe, like Elvis is still alive, 9/11 was an inside job, and also Donald Trump won the election. Like, those people are just, like, you're never, but the harmony with those folks is not possible. You know, if you wait for harmony with those folks, and, you know, if you wait to do what we've been doing, or the reason why our democracy is so screwed up, is because Mitch McConnell wants to wait for those guys to decide, like, those guys get a veto over everything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we could have, what's that?
I said, isn't he one of those guys, though? So,
well, so, I mean,
there's a lot of pictures with him with the Sons of Confederacy.
Right, right. So it's hard for me to tell.
Not a political move I would make, even if I was from Kentucky.
You know, I think he has one true love, and that is money. I really believe that about him. I think that anything that he does with, like, you know, Confederates, whoever, it's all in service to his one true love and God, money. I think he has no other higher power in his life than money. I think that's his worship basis. And if those groups can get him more money or get him more ways to get more money, I think that he is behind that. But you know, but that 10% of people, we're never going to have, racial harmony with that 10%. Like, and if we wait around for that 10% to be like, hey, yeah, I'm into racial harmony, it's never going to happen. And like, so I think one important thing we need to do is to stop waiting around for those people and to form ways where we aren't waiting around for those people. And if that means, like, you know, if that means making Washington, D.C. a state, which, you know, it should be, you know, letting Puerto Rico be a state, which it should be, in my opinion, if they want to be. Like, for Puerto Rico, it's a matter of whether or not they want to be. Washington, D.C., like, they don't have, they're stateless, voteless, you know, oppressed right now. But Puerto Rico, you know, that's up to them what they want. You know, if we find, but even on the local level, you know, we need to find ways where, I mean, sometimes I worry that police are often drawn for that 10% of men. So, you know, we have to find a way to work around and work through those guys where we just don't include them. Like, we just say, no, you're not invited to this conversation because you're only here to stop it. Like, well, you're not here to further it. So,
and I think you touched on something that's very important in the ways that the economy, money, and by proxy power play into how harmonious or not we are, especially when it comes to race in this country. And part of that 10% and how they're so disenfranchised is that there are rich white men like Mitch McConnell or the Waltons or whoever else taking advantage of almost everybody. And then you also have people like Mitch McConnell drawing a line down the middle and goes, oh, everyone who's poor, who's not white on this side, and everyone who's poor and white on this side, and you guys fight each other. Because if you guys get together, we're screwed. You know, and that has been an age-old play forever. And part of that 10% of people that are so upset, that are the, you know, the old white men who, you know, were like, oh, we need to bring coal back to West Virginia. And it's like, man, if there was ever a group that needed coal never to come back, it's you guys who have been literally oppressed by that industry and by those horrible people forever. And if you should be able to relate to anyone, it's this same group of people who've had the same struggles forever. But yet again, we let the people with the money make those sort of like divisions, and everyone ends up frustrated. I think the productive thing that's happened is that it's been really easy to tell who a lot of those people are now, thanks to, you know, the Black Lives Matter movements and marches and protests around the country. The people who are like, but small business owners, this, I read a story somewhere, someone put a post on Facebook about this family who had their small business destroyed. It's like, no, they didn't. And you're just talking about money again. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm sure some people's businesses and things may got messed up at some point, but also a lot of people have died. And if I had to choose between my small business and people's lives, it's not a hard choice. But again, those people who've bought into that money narrative, especially as it relates to race, you know, that's all they talk about. And again, I think the one nice thing about all that is, you know who all those people are now, because a lot of them were like your aunts and uncles and cousins and other people, you know, and it was really easy to go like, okay, see ya. I don't even need to be friends with you on Facebook anymore. Like, and it's cool because now we don't have to see each other this year at all. So that's my soapbox rant. About
it has been weird seeing how some white relatives like shake out. I will say it has been weird. Like some people shook out in places that I did not expect, you know, in part because they have grandkids that they care about and they see their lives to those grandkids that, are not the same skin color as them and have a different life. And, so I see the effects of that. And that doesn't mean that everybody who has, you know, a little black or brown grandkid is doing great on these issues. That does not mean that at all. But it is interesting to see how these things are shaking out in predominantly white families. And it has been quite the 2020 on that front. Yeah. Karen, I lost at least one cousin to pure, like, I mean, I don't even know. This is not a close cousin, but my dad did inform me that I have one QAnon cousin now, and I was like, oh, oof. God.
So, does that ever happen, you know, with the black community like that? I mean, I'm sure there's some, but I mean, it's easy for me because like half my relatives are from the South. So, you know, who to just be like later when they start kind of ranting about, you know, well, the reason Nancy Pelosi and all of them showed up in white because they're part of a witch cult or whatever. You know, it's easy on this side. Does the same thing happen sort of in the black community in that way? I've always, because, you know, everyone has crazy relatives, but again, 2020 brought for, you know, like my family anyways, brought them like all out in full force.
Yeah. So I would say yes. It shows up differently though.
Yeah.
And so when George Floyd happened, and I think going back to the earlier statement, one of the reasons why it was such a huge impact is because 2020 made everybody stop. And so you had nothing else to do but to sit and look at your phone for that entire time going, okay, when does this end? And this is starting to look crazy. Mm-hmm. And you hear this gentleman, you know, crying out for his mother and all those things. Everybody had to watch that. It wasn't, I was at work and somebody told me about it. It was, no, somebody filmed it and we watched it in real time. But then so there were conversations that were starting to happen about, you know, the very militant black people who said, this is why we've got to rise up and we've got to take over. And, you know, you can't trust the system. You can't trust white people. You can't trust, you know, anybody but ourselves, we only need to care about ourselves. Then there were some who were probably who were more moderate who were saying, well, I don't know, you know, you can't trust everybody. Because there and again, you have to remember, part of this is the whole construct of race is built around wealth. Mm-hmm. And so I'm having conversations with individuals, even in, and not just in my community, but also in my family, who are millionaires because they were pro athletes. And so, and for them, it's, well, my treatment has been a little bit different, you know? And so, there were those who were, well, what was he doing? You know, was he really? And I was like, dude, no, if it was you, would you want me to ask, well, what was he doing there? Like, you know, and so, but then there were those who were, they experienced PTSD, I guess is the best way to put it. And so you had those boomers, my mother and her generation, who for them, this looked like something that they saw when it was the lunch counters and the bus boycotts and all of those things. And for them, there was this post-traumatic stress syndrome kind of a feel to those conversations. And so, we all started to see even within our communities just the diversity of thought and the diversity of the effect of all the racial things that happen. And it was tough. And it was really weird because that played out not just in the church, but in our families. Uh-huh. People were having the conversation. People were forcing the conversations. And then you have now this, you know, this Gen Z group of people, you know, who are all still in middle school and junior and high school, or, you know, they've got black friends, they've got white friends, they've got Hispanic friends, they've got Korean friends, they've got, and they're having these conversations and it's almost a foreign concept to them. And since it's because they've not yet experienced what we term the real world, had that experience. And so it's been very different. It's been, I have had conversations with people who, you know, just because of the racial tension have just broken down and cried, you know, I can't take this anymore. And others who were ready to go burn something down, mm-hmm. you know. And then have those people who are saying, well, I don't want to burn anything down. And then those two people be at odds because one wants to be incredibly militant and one does not. Oh, well, we got to go pray. And like, okay, we've prayed long enough. Let's go do something. And so it's created those conversations about how to respond. You know, and so it's been really interesting. You know, I can say from my church's perspective, it has been really interesting this year, just dealing with all of that, because, you know, 70% of my congregation is white. You know, and so these conversations have happened. You know, the whole thing around Trump, we've had people who have said, you know, I can't come to church because even though we're a parking lot or whatever, people are talking about politics and I don't want to be a part of it. You know, it's all layered in. And so, you know, for persons like myself, it's hard sometimes to have that conversation on the personal level when you kind of take like the preacher hat off, because, you know, I'm trying to help bridge the gap because every white person isn't trying to kill me, you know.
Right.
You know, every Asian person doesn't, you know, think I'm a bum or, you know, whatever. It's been very difficult. And I posted about the stress of the black psychology, the black psyche during 2020. And I felt like every black person needed to go to counseling, to go to therapy after 2020, just because of the stress that it created.
Sure.
And I think some of that has led into where we are with the presidential election. Mm-hmm. I think that is what I think in a weird, very weird, really weird way, you know, it helped fuel the movement to say, okay, because people that haven't voted their whole lives voted this time. In the black community.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's an interesting question, too, if we're looking and we're trying to examine, you know, do a postmortem on, I guess, Biden winning the election. Did he win yesterday for, like, the 18th time since November? You know, looking at how much of that was a referendum. I mean, it's a lot of things, but how much of it was a referendum on race? How much of it was a referendum on just Trump in general? How much of it was about, you know, just returning to, again, your church being able to have, you know, service without it being political, or without having to worry about, you know, having to bring up race or politics? I think, you know, especially if you look at somewhere like Georgia, which flipped. I mean, just barely, but, you know, a lot of places went from hard red to purple or blue as a result. And so, again, trying to figure out how much, again, race and all those things played into the election.
Yeah, and I think it really has in ways that I think people didn't predict prior to 2020. Mm-hmm. You know, for a lot of people prior to 2020, there was almost this feeling of, well, nothing's going to change. You know, we may have to ride this out for 4 more years and everything's going to be as it is. And then things started to happen and this snowball kind of took effect. And when you think about the COVID response in the early part of the year, when you think about just the number of deaths, when you think about the social injustice, the racial injustice, we start talking about, say, the PPE distribution. Uh-huh. I had two conversations earlier this week in reference to that. One about minority-owned businesses, because I do some consulting, and so we were talking about, you know, a strategy with a particular business about how to get in line if they do that again. But also from the church perspective, you know, because that exposed a good old boy system yet again.
Wow, of course. Well, that was one of the best things I thought that got brought up during the election was anytime Trump would refer to any of the Democratic candidates as socialist, it's like, listen, the only difference between the type of socialism we believe in and the type of socialism you believe in is that socialism is only for people who don't need it, who are primarily male, who are primarily white, and we believe that the government should be helping everyone.
Right.
And yeah, I think those things became very clear there towards the end. And the ways that, you know, hey, we're going to bail Wall Street out again because those poor guys during this whole recession and the economic impact of everything. But, you know, when it comes to the stimulus stuff for the rest of the country, you guys can just really,
I think,
don't worry. It'll trickle down.
Yeah. And I think too, so 2020 just exposed all of these inequities that folks did not have to face before. Like, we could turn blind eyes to people being hungry, to the crisis that we have in housing, affordable housing, homelessness, you know, lack of childcare, like people can't afford childcare. Our educational system, which has had to drastically change. For some of our children may be thriving, some certainly are not. Some of these parents are capable of teaching their children. Fortunately, I don't have children that have to suffer through me teaching them. But some of, you know, parents aren't in a position that they can, you know, help their children in these educational pieces. And so all of these inequities that have been exposed, now we have this opportunity to put systems and strategies and talk really intelligently about how do we work towards a more equitable society, which is what we, you know.
To me, one of the wildest things about 2020, like, is that kind of almost on accident, like, and just out of sheer panic, on the behalf of, on the part of Republicans, we had a stimulus that actually went to individuals, mm-hmm. like, that went to, like, and made sure that people, like, at the, you know, the first one, the first bailout, you know, not bailout, but, you know, CARES package, whatever you want to call it, the first CARES went to people. Like, and yes, there was also, like, don't get me wrong, there was a ton of grift and graft on the business side of things. Like, I'm not excusing that. Mm-hmm. But, like, those checks that went to people directly and the unemployment benefits that are about, you know, about set to run out, those things really materially impacted people's bottom lines and people who really, I mean, on the desperate end of the bottom line. And that is the first time we've ever done this incredibly effective thing, which is to give money to people who desperately need it to just pay the rent and put food in their mouths and then just leave them alone. Like, they will take care of whatever else. You know, we have this, you know, Republicans are like, oh, well, we believe in individuals, but then, like, they don't just believe, you know, they accidentally did this experiment where they gave individuals money and it actually worked out pretty well. Like, those individuals, you know, used it to make sure they had a roof over their head and to make sure that they fed their kids. Right. And, like, maybe we should do more of that. and I hope in memory holding 2020 and all the traumas and all the like layers of pain and just disruption, that we don't forget that we did something incredibly effective, that Republicans did something incredibly effective and beneficial to people that makes society more equitable. And we should try more of that, and that we should make that the new consensus. Like, I think part of what's going on right now is we're looking for kind of a new consensus. Like, the old consensus was, like, the era of big government is broken, as Bill Clinton said, or whatever, or the era of big government is over, or whatever. That, you know, that was the old consensus under, you know, Reagan, from Reagan on. And, you know, even under Obama, like, that consensus didn't totally break. But now I think we have a real break with that, but we also have a real, like, scramble to figure out what we're going to put in its place. And that scramble, I hope desperately that we are able to, you know, not put back our big business gods who have fallen off the pedestal so many times we can't, you know, we can't keep track, but to put up, like, you know, some collectivism and some just trusting each other as community, that, like, when you give people money for the absolute essentials, like, they'll use it for the absolute essentials and, like, you know, just let people, like, kind of have enough to get by is, like, the best thing that you can possibly do for society. Mm-hmm.
It will be interesting how people talk about this next year and a lot of things that happen, because, you know, it's like with, remember we had Medicaid or Medicare expansion in Virginia and all the Republicans voted against it. And then when they got up for election again, they're like, oh no, I was totally all for it. Mm-hmm. Once you guys realize that it actually affected you, my core base. And I think it'll be similar, you know, it's like, hey, remember when we did that great thing and everybody got that money and we were able to, you know, not have to, I don't know, sell off the family cow and, you know, whatever.
Try to get three beans.
Yeah, exactly. you know, but then you guys, after that worked, you held it up again and again and again and again, and all these business closed. Well, no, I was all for, remember when I was all for it? Not when I was holding up because I wanted to, again, prop up some, you know, ridiculous lawsuit that the state of Texas was filing. You know, again, I'm going to be curious to see the people who have a different song next year about this whole thing once everybody realized the good it actually did, and the long-term good it did for the economy and for people in general. And again, I think it's going to, with especially people like Ben Klein, it's going to be interesting when he goes, oh, you know, I'm a big states rights guy. You know, big states rights, states rights. That's why I supported that thing by Texas that prides itself on being a you know, its own state, wanting to take away other states' votes and rights. And so that kind of, again, backtracking next year, I'm a little excited about it.
Well, no, I think it's also going to be interesting to see how the tax, when the new tax law comes out, for so that people that start filing in 2021, how all of that shakes out. Because, you know, there's still that, hey, we gave it to you, but so we don't know yet what the tax law that for people who are filing in 2021 is going to look like and how all of that kind of plays out. So I think that will be the true testament to how much of that was just pure goodwill, mm-hmm. or how much of it was we're just shifting and we're going to take part of that back. So when we move to 2021, that first quarter 2021 is going to be really interesting to see how all of that kind of, because I think that's what we'll kind of see it really play out as we move into that first quarter of 2021.
Yeah, I'm no accountant, and I definitely, you know, I was unemployed during the hard part of the pandemic, and that, you know, my kid's mom is a teacher, and they still had to keep going to school and doing weird stuff, so I, you know, that was the only way I was able to take care of the kids and get bills paid and all that kind of stuff. And technically, that bump in unemployment that they gave everybody, I'm supposed to pay taxes on at some point. There was no money left over. I'm still like $6,000 in debt. So like, I don't know where that all that money is going to come from, you know, after the fact. So hopefully, again, you know, it might be that we write off student loans or whatever else. But maybe one of the other things will be just like, guys, this was a gift from the government. Just go do something nice with it. Be, you know. Yeah. Be a good person.
Yeah. So you guys, this is, you know, I always love talking to y'all, and this is like so insightful, and I hope as people are listening, they're having these same types of conversations. But as we're moving into 2021, probably the date I'm most looking forward to is January 20th at noon, but I digress. But what are kind of as we are putting 2020 kind of in the rearview mirror, where are we looking forward to in 2021?
The vaccine, baby, as that meme has been saying. You know, there's a meme going around amongst all the healthcare workers, and it's me and my health. You know, I'm a little worried about this mRNA vaccine. Me and my healthcare worker friends, give it to me in my eye. Like, you know, so, you know, where the folks who, a lot of the folks, I'm not going to say 100%, but a lot of the folks who have been working healthcare are very enthusiastic about this. And I am too. Like, this is an incredibly effective vaccine. I'm super excited for my parents to get it. I am like one of the last people in line. You know, it's not clear what's going to happen with kids, mm-hmm. but I'm super excited about them being able to produce it quickly. They should, because of, you know, this is easier to produce than a lot of other types of vaccines that we make. And it was engineered specifically that way. And I also want to say like that, you know, like the Moderna vaccine and the development of these types of vaccines was done in part, by someone who's a biochemist for the NIH, who's a Black female scientist, you know, and has like, you know, overseen so much of this work. And I hope that and some of the images of like in New York, like the first image was of, you know, a Black doctor giving a Black nurse, both women, the vaccine. And I hope that, that those images are able to kind of like get through to people on an emotional level, like that this is safe and this is effective and this is what's going to get you back to being able to be with your church community and hugging and doing these things that like I really do believe and having normal grieving, like our grieving has been so disrupted this year and normal school and just so many things. And I don't know, I just hope that the Biden administration is as equitable as possible and distributing this. And by equitable, I don't mean like, you know, I mean, we look out for people's vulnerabilities first and foremost and say, okay, you know, how do we protect? Because this vaccine is incredibly effective. And so how do we protect the most vulnerable first and then work our way down the, you know, the ways of get, you know, and get it to everyone as quickly and equitably as possible, you know, thinking about, you know, that some people may be harder to reach and get to. Mm-hmm. And should we let people who just are easier to get to jump in line, or should we put that effort in to make sure, you know, as things are limited that we get it out to everyone. So, but I'm looking forward to it. I desperately want it. if we want to do anything in 2021, you know, having people call in and ask questions about it, you know, I've read up on it, like, for myself, and, you know, as my, you know, for my training. So I know all about it, and I'm happy to answer people's questions, and I hope we just have a good rollout.
What you're saying is you work for Bill Gates and 5G.
I wish I worked for Bill Gates, baby. My taxes would, my end of the tax return would look a lot better. Let me tell you, my end of the tax return is a little slim in comparison to my partner's end of the tax return. So it's not nothing, but it's a little slim. So Bill Gates wants to send me some money, I'm taking it.
Well, I think also part of that too is the need to bridge the gap for some of those communities, not just with access, but also with the conversation. So I think that conversation piece is huge, because we also understand that there is this huge gap in trust within the different communities. Yeah. The African-American community, I'm a 10-year military veteran. I go to the VA for nothing. Just gonna be honest. You know, I go to the VA when they call me and say, hey, we need you to come in. If they don't call me, I don't go, because I've seen the science experiments. You know, my great uncles and uncles, and I've heard some of the horror stories. And so when you start thinking about it from the context of the Black community, there is this sense of distrust with the medical community. Even now, you know, there are moments when my wife or just family or friends, where we have these conversations about how much harder you have to fight. Mm-hmm. You know, when dealing with a doctor, and I worked at Ruddock Memorial for a couple of years, and, you know, and I saw it, and I would have people pull me to the side and say, hey, are they telling me the truth? You know, and I'm like, well, I'm just here to do a psych eval, but what did they tell you? What did they tell you? I don't know. And so you would, you know, so I think as they roll it out, having these open, honest conversations where you're able to gain trust and answer people's questions with sincerity and honesty, I think are going to be huge. So I am excited for at least hearing at this juncture that there are people who are really ready to kind of to do that, because you're going to need to be able to have that as a piece. I know one of the things I'm hoping for with this next CARES package, I don't know what they're calling it, is I don't know if any of you guys paid attention, but every Saturday for the last months since September, October, in the Big Lots parking lot in Hirschberger, there have been tractor trailers that pull up, and there's been food distribution that happens. Uh-huh. It's that farmers, the families, food distribution. And, you know, we go out, and we've volunteered at it several times now. And, I mean, thousands upon thousands of boxes of food that go out every Saturday. Well, I think next week is the last one. And so while we've not been Houston or Orlando or, you know, L.A. or any place like that where you see, you know, these huge numbers of people in a, you know, 2,500 people in a day, or, you know, we've had it here in Southwest Virginia. That's one of the things I don't think people have really talked about. You know, we were out there last Saturday, and there were people coming from Christiansburg, Blacksburg, the Lynchburg area, you know, showing up 2-3 hours early to park at the parking lot to get in line to make sure they got a box. And like last week, that we ran out and people were still coming. Mm-hmm. So when I'm thinking about 2021, those are the kind of things that also need to continue, at least for a while, until we get everybody vaccinated and the businesses that can come back do come back. And because that we need, going back to Catherine's earlier point, we need to make sure that we're still being as equitable with people as we can. And you see people out there, you know, all walks of life. And so I think, you know, I'm looking forward to that kind of stuff, I think, in 2021 as well. Hoping that it kind of comes back and it keeps happening, because, you know, we don't like to talk about it. And with Roanoke in particular being the 7-time All-American city, but the number of homeless people in Roanoke is insane. Uh-huh. You know, and so when you talk about that, that number is now in the thousands, and we don't like to talk about that. You know, the ability to be able to provide services in 2021 is going to be huge, because people are coming from everywhere. You know, we don't talk about it, but Roanoke has encampments of homeless people. And I, you know, homeless people aren't all bad people. Some people just didn't have a plan to keep them from being homeless. So I think in 2021, I'm hoping to continue to see, you know, the faith communities coming together, the businesses that can come together, and hoping that the government, as its next, as part of its next stimulus, is going to do some of that as well. And also, you know, to Will, I think it was Will that said earlier, Will, if they will shave off a little bit off of my high liberty student loan, I will not be mad.
Yeah. You know, I think to your point too, Kevin, I have a handful of libertarian friends because I'm like 40 and a bunch of them are male. And so one of the things that I've seen with them, and considering just how broad of a reach you can have, and, you know, just simple things like wearing a mask, which for a lot of people is still somehow an issue. You know, I had a friend the other day talking about how, you know, his wife's going to, their, you know, business is going to get shut down if people keep showing up and refusing to wear a mask. It has nothing to do with the business. It has nothing to do with whatever. It has to do with these very myopic people. Mm-hmm. And whether you think, you know, masks are necessary or not, it's like, just do it for the small businesses. And I think that kind of mindset and those people doing those things now, that shift, I think, is going to be big. And some of those people are outliers, but I look at the outliers for the way that we shift sort of as a society, because if the far side is kind of moving in that way, it's, you know, the center is going to be, you know, is already there or is moving along with it. So I think those things are going to be big and in 2021. And again, like you said, looking at the amount of homelessness that has occurred because of the pandemic, looking at the, again, any of the cracks that have showed up in our churches, society, government, you name it. But on the bright side, I am looking forward to a bunch of the new leadership. You know, Robert called it that it was going to be Joe Biden, and I, at the time, I was like, but now I'm totally fine with him. Good. Just anybody at this point who's a rational adult. And the same with Robert. You know, big congratulations to Robert for getting on city council. You know, Trish reelected, and Sherman and all of them, the whole slate, like, you know, it was, I think it's going to be really good for the city. I think there's a lot of good people who are well equipped to tackle the problems that we're going to be looking at next year. And that's encouraging, because before, you know, again, it's like I said, the handling of the pandemic or any response to, you know, Iran or North Korea or anything, it was like, I would wake up in the middle of the night and be like, oh God, now I have these other things to worry about on top of all these other things, on top of these other things, because I don't know how these people are going to handle these things. And I don't think 2021 is going to be a walk in the park, but at least I can get some sleep again knowing that, like, okay, we didn't, you know, it's not Dr. Strangelove. Like, we can go back to bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things for me, I work with a program in Radford Fair Lawn Daily Bread, and coordinate our Meals on Wheels program. And there is this generosity that I've seen from particularly my Radford, Blacksburg, Christiansburg communities in not just continuing service, but expanding services. You know, for example, Sunday, we put together our emergency meal boxes. It's like 5 to 7 meals for a day like today, where people wouldn't either be able to come to get a meal or we can't deliver. But I've seen that generosity of spirit everywhere in helping our neighbors. And I'm hoping in 2021 that continues. You know, all of the things that we have to work on, the ills of our society, I'm hoping that this generosity of spirit continues, because I think the call on all of our lives is to help our neighbors and to be there for our neighbors. And our neighbors aren't just the people that are right beside us. It is the greater community at large. And so I hope that that generosity continues going forward. So any last thoughts before I close us out?
I think we covered everything, right?
That was 2020 in a nutshell.
I can't wait to hear who the next Secretary of Education is going to be.
Oh.
Just putting that out there, you know.
Not going to miss her either.
I'm telling you. January 20th, I think we need to have a party at noon January 20th. Instead of celebrating New Year's Eve, let's celebrate, you know,
we're gonna bang the
inauguration and in ways that we haven't before. Like, I may wait and cook my black eyed peas on January 20th versus the first day, because it's like all brand new, you know, all brand new. So thank all of y'all, and thank you for listening to Our Voices, Our Community, presented by Colors Virginia Magazine. You can also listen to us each Sunday at 3 p.m. on WROE 95.7 Radio Free Roanoke. We're going to come back to you all with a new season mid-January, and we cannot wait. If you like what you've heard today, leave us a review. Also, be sure to like Our Voices, Our Community on Facebook. Thanks, everybody.